management.
We have to go to the Judicial Service Commission. That must explain why we are so confused. But the suggestion that we call back relevant is quite acceptable. We want to have a committee that really is on the table. We want to have an active parliament. So that's the question. I don't think it's the case. So let's get down to it. The strategic plan
Thank you, Chair. Testing and members of the committee and colleagues. The document that you should have for you are three documents. One is 1 month strategic plan for the constitutional development, which is really a high level slide presentation of the key areas that the department is going to be focusing on. I'm trying to arrange through the department for the members to get an electronic version of the document and the details of the MCSF document. The other document is the 1 month the National Prosecuting Authority of South Africa Strategic Plan. Those are the documents we'll be taking through today for this presentation. As much as possible when I present, I will try and indicate the areas where you find you should expect similarities between the activities of the Department of National Office and the activities of the NPA. They really all are linked and talking about them. When the NPA also presents, then you'll be able to follow through pretty easily. The first plan then for the department, that's three key strategic goals. The first one being access to justice for all. And really what we try to do on this one is to have activities in the department. But firstly, they must follow, and all of them must follow from the government's program of action, the MCSF of government, which is currently being discussed and understand before cabinet. And for approval, it's discussed with cabinet proposal. So all of our activities then follow from that MCSF. MCSF document for the next 5 years in just greater quantity. So with respect to access to justice for all, what we're talking about in those bullet points are different activities that seek to achieve justice for all. Chairperson, one of those is with respect to the construction of court infrastructure. As part of the rollout of services in many communities where we find that there are no justice or adequate justice services, we try to compensate for this by constructing courts and bringing them closer to the community, because we know that historically our courts have largely been concentrated in the more urban areas. So in the outlying areas, townships and rural areas, we always find that there aren't enough courts. So we try to have a program in terms of which on an annual basis. There are courts being constructed, and because the programs that overlap, constructed a fully blown court, it will take anything between 15 months to 24 months if all goes well, if you take into account all of the processes that are involved in it. So the programs are always overlapping from financial aid to financial aid. That's one of those things. The other way of doing it is to try to obtain offices and accommodation where we offer other justice services other than the hearing of trial, because the hearing of cases can only take place in court. But it's not only through the hearing of cases that we provide services. Sometimes we provide other services that don't relate to that. And those really can be offered anywhere there's accommodation. So we also try to do that in that particular context. We also work with community organizations to improve provision of justice services. Last year we used community development workers from an altitude perspective. We need to run programs of constitutional education, those types of things. We try and have partnerships with as many stakeholders as possible. Some of those constitutional development programs are run directly by our Chapter 9 institutions, for example, the Commission on Gender Equality, the Human Rights Commission, and they deal with those directly. So we provide support to them by having our own separate programs. But largely, they dominate the constitutional development agenda as Chapter 9 institutions. One of the other programs that we are moving with speed and its energy. This year is ensuring that the course used all 11 languages. The tradition has been that course used largely English and Afrikaans, and from the beginning of this year, we started a pilot project which is slowly being expanded throughout wherever possible, where cases, if possible, where they can be run in all languages. They are run in all languages. As part of our normal work and as part of the review, one of the things that we noted as contributing factors to delays in court cases being run properly, delays in just the efficient provision of services, is that language is a major factor. You know, we spend a lot of time on interpretation because you know, you find that quite ordinarily in a place where the parties, including the presiding officer, predominantly speak a particular language, let's say the court or Japan, that case runs in English, and somebody has to provide an interpretation service for the one of the people involved in the same language. So what we've tried to do and argue in engaging with the judiciary is that all of us should seek to ensure that in cases like the mentor should just run in the language that's common to all. Then it depends on the interpretation system, and that ensures the greater quality of what is presented before the court, and there's no dispute about what is being interpreted and what is not being interpreted. So this is something that we started running, so everyone is making adjustments to accommodate, you know, from the MPA, by the positions that are concerned to the judiciary. Because what it will then obviously affect is the manner in which cases then are allocated, because we do find that in many jurisdictions, you may find that the positions are in the legal counsel and the accused person will speak a common language, but the judicial officer will not necessarily speak that language. So another set of things, there is still the need for interpretation services to be provided, and vice versa. You know, the defense counsel may not be the one who speaks the language common to all, so that doesn't also occur to all the constitutions in the case. But the main thrust of the problem is that as much as possible, people should be able to speak the language of choice, their first language, and in a court, and we shouldn't always carry through the tradition. So it's creating a couple of logistic challenges, but the adjustments, we believe, by the end of the financial year, we should be able to have overcome, and then usually we should start having the second round smoothly. It has implications cost-wise, because what it means is that the record must now also be interpreted. So if a trial has been done in one particular language, because there are always process of appeal, the department must now make sure that that transcript which should be, let's say, in Kivenda is now translated into English and at least Afrikaans. Because when the matter gets taken on appeal, the presiding officer that is getting the matter on appeal won't necessarily have understanding of the trial, you know, the sort of record language. So, but it's a key problem for us, which has been spoken of. The other program to raise to the second last bullet point, activities designed to protect you know, women and vulnerable women and children and poor people. So we'll get to those details later on. So that's really is a strategic goal one, access to justice for all. With a sense of strategic goal two, enhancing organizational efficiency, what we're trying to focus on here are ways in which government can deliver services better, more efficient, and at the same time ensure that there is a widespread of services. And one of the ways in which we've concluded, and it has been shown where we've tried this work best, is with respect to the second last bullet point, using technology to roll out services. The main thrust is obviously that those who have access to technology, your people in your professional rank, your magistrates and your judiciary, we need to provide them with the necessary tools to be able to do their work easier. So tried within the commission, the budget available to make sure that they have all of the, what we call together with them, tools of trade. So we make sure that computers, their laptops, their travel, their access to the engine, their access to an electronic library, in addition to the hardcore library that they normally would have in the court. So from that perspective, your basic services are provided to them as much as possible. Similarly, with our official deliver services, we want to make sure that they have those types of services, which they do. The greater challenge arises with respect to the audience, because you know, we put a lot of information as well on our website. We've been rolling out systems, for example, the ICMS, which is the Integrated Case Management System, which helps us run all of the court processes electronically. So in other words, we're moving from an environment where the court processes, the various court processes, whether civil or criminal, are done manually to where they're done electronically. So our officials are able to move and cope with it as much as possible. But what it means is that in the ordinary environment, you then want to provide access to the external parties to the system. Now, not everyone that we interact with or that uses the court has knowledge of IT. So if you want somebody to really start following their maintenance case, for example, many of those people will not be able to access. But maybe the professionals will be able to. So we've been trying to phase in the modernization of the processes and as it were in stages. So what we've done so far is to firstly ensure that the key documents are safe, so the dockets. The dockets are scanned into the electronic system in the court on a daily basis so that we have them saved electronically. So that if a hard copy gets lost, it doesn't create problems. It simply creates the docket again and then it's able to run. So by and large, the system is already in place and it's running. So on average, almost 90% of all the dockets that go to court will be scanned electronically. And we're now trying to roll that out to the police services as well. The second thing that we've been developing a system with in the civil file are also captured electronically, so that they are captured and there's no lost file. And that is work in progress. We hope to have it finished by the end of this financial year. And what it really means is that with the docket, you know that at the end of the investigation, before the commencement of the trial, the defense always requests a full copy of the docket. What we're trying to get at is a stage where we don't provide hard copies. You can simply email it, and they can print it themselves. It will save us the trouble of having to print for them, and then we charge them one rand a page, things. So those programs are underway, and they are being implemented in different stages, in the different areas. But that's the main thrust behind the use of information technology in the system. It puts pressure on the whole system because if you roll out services and you roll out your IT system, it puts pressure on your network. So you need to make sure that your network is properly in place. So that takes a little bit longer because it then depends on other service providers like telecom coming to play to assist us. So again, we are fortunate because at least as a department in all of the courts, we have the network in place. And it's just now improving the bandwidth. So what you possibly hear from many colleagues is that on a day-to-day basis, they find that it's slow. And it's really nice because of the volume and the pressure that it's under. So we work with telecom to now and again keep increasing the bandwidth as we roll. What it has done, which we've noticed, is that yes, while it makes life difficult for colleagues, because all of a sudden they must know how to use the computers and stuff, from end of the hearing, it does, however, enable us to deal with bad practices that have always been there, consequent of using a manual system. We've reduced the incidence of documents going missing. We've reduced the incidence of dockets going missing in the court. So if you hear that a docket is lost, in all probability it's not lost in the court, it's lost at the police station or with the investigating officer. So as a department across the board, we find that the continued use of information technology is the better route to go going forward, but the challenge around use is one that we should note. And we should note it largely in the context of the judiciary as well. We continue to engage with the judiciary, and I think it gets taken for granted that everyone should be familiar with it. I think you'd be surprised that most of the judiciary officers are not quite conversant with information technology, and a lot of training has to be spent assessing the code of conduct. So it's something to note going forward, and various breakdowns can be provided and oneness. Like five strategic goal three, transform justice, state, and society. I think this is one that's going to be possibly one of the more challenging ones, because if you're talking about transformation, I think it invokes different emotions from different people. Generally, we've always accepted that transformation, or taken for granted that transformation, talks to racial and gender demographics. It doesn't only talk, it also talks to the general transformation of practice. The way that we've grown accustomed to performing certain services, in many instances, have been transformed. Typical example that just as a kid, the fact that the transfer of criminal justice is even a heavy jurisdiction. We are as quick, we are ready. As a slight provocation, for want of a better expression. And then a lot of work gets spent trying to make it clear. In the meantime, you have somebody else there, either in custody, if they cannot afford to pay a bail, and that kind of thing. And then that turns out maybe that's not the person responsible for the offense. The person who spends time is away from custody, when in fact, more time is spent on the investigation, or time spent first on the investigation, you could have avoided things. So those are practices that are traditional to our criminal justice system as the Republic. Now, if you talk about transformation, how do you transform an area like this? How do you introduce it as an area for other transformation, especially in the context of the human rights culture and the Constitution? So when you talk about transformation, therefore, we talk broadly, more than just issues of gender demographics. The current point that the media is writing about relating to the minister's request to have the postponement of the interview for justice on account of wanting to have an opportunity to consider a broader transformation issue. Again, when one looks at those types of issues, we need to be aware that, and understand that indeed there is a need to do this. And therefore, before we move forward, we need to have a common understanding about how we're going to take the transformation agenda, so that we don't sort of do it after the fact, after things have been done. So it's important to have a greater understanding. Now, in this case, we've got a number of activities that talk to the transformation agenda. You will see at the top of the first bullet point that underway is the review of the criminal justice system. You may have heard of it. It's work in progress. It's also being implemented and reviewed. So there's quite a number of things that are actually being done pursuant to the review work. We are also starting this year with the review of the civil justice, working together with the Rules Board. So when you talk review of the criminal justice system, review of the civil justice system, we're looking at all practices that currently exist. It doesn't mean that there will necessarily be an amendment in the legislation. What it means is there may be a need to change in which certain services are performed. With respect to the third bullet point, what we are doing there again, we've changed the provision of this is the state services and installing the state services and the grandest function in that we now have moved from a minor system to an electronic system. For the same benefits that I mentioned with respect to docket, also with respect to the provisions. And I always say to colleagues when we discussed this with the department is that it is 3-4 years ago, now and again, there was always an article in the media about some problem with the time of funds. In fact, for the past 18 months, I don't think any of you would say they remember any article negative about any problem with the time of funds. And I'm quite confident that it's consequent upon going electronically, because we can now do easy audits, we can track allocation of money. So we've done away very significantly with manual checks. So we do a lot of things electronically. So as a result, we've almost eliminated any form of inappropriate practice, corruption, or fraud as the case is. So from that perspective, we're quite confident that we'll deal with that aspect of the guidance fund. What we are still trying to deal with is with respect to ensuring that the normal process is around 15 to 16. Adhere to throughout the country more consistently, especially in that areas where some of these services are not really readily available, like Pumalanga, for example. People still travel, some of them from Pumalanga to some of these services. So we're still looking at the rollout of services. Promoting judicial transparency. This is one of the areas of transformation within the judiciary that we're going to engage in the judiciary about, to try and see how we can ensure that there is transparency. Because one of the reasons why there's sometimes comments in the media, because there is maybe a lack of understanding about what is supposed to be done, and people resort easily to alleging, you know, interference when there actually isn't interference. So one of the ways of addressing those types of concerns and those misconceptions is through greater transparency, greater understanding. And I think it's something that all of us should seek to do, so that we help the public better understand issues. The question is, how do you ensure judicial transparency other than just through publication of court judgments, which is generally being done? You know, so there must be other ways in which there is a greater engagement with the public about court decisions, so that they are not misunderstood necessarily, and also so that the uncomments made are necessarily there and appropriate. The other area is with respect to implementing TRC recommendations. It's an ongoing area. We've made significant progress in this regard, in that during the course of last year, we did submit various cabinet memoranda proposing regulations to further implement TRC recommendations. So as those get approved, we're going to go full steam with implementation. I'm on slide 7 now, which is Effective Administration Program 1. There are 4 programs of the department, and you see them as you go through. Effective Administration. This really admin is national office, so your corporate services area. The most important thing to note there is that we currently have 2,741 vacancies. If I recall, a major decrease. You know, we previously had a much higher, I can't remember the exact figure, but we had a much higher vacancy rate from the beginning of last year. We spent a bit of time during the course of the year to make sure that we fill in as many of these vacancies as possible. And this excludes the MP. This excludes the MP, and this is just the national office. This is 2,741 of a total of about 15,000 people. So we're trying at all stages to keep the vacancy rate in single digits. So it vacillates sometimes, 12% and 13%. So the time it was 22%, and we're quite confident that we've reduced significantly. Part of the challenge in this, because we looked at whether or not you can absolutely eliminate, I don't think it's possible, but I think it can be a lot less than that, because we found that because government has different, well, at different levels, yes, but in the same pool offer different salaries. So we find that somebody comes to justice and we pay them 80,000. And they quickly realize that another department with the same post, the same function, they get paid 95,000 and they immediately apply, and sometimes they get the post. So there's a lot of movement of officials within government purely because people see better remuneration in other departments and they do the same thing. So we found that at the level of administration, where these vacancies largely exist, we find that this is a problem. We also have to work harder to achieving employment equity targets. The client has as many people at a high level, representatives of the gender and the disability area. We are not yet at 50% at senior level. Our target is to get 50%, we are not yet at 50% at senior management level. So this is a particular challenge. Also, with respect to 2% of people with disabilities, I think we are on about 1.5%, so we're not yet at 2%. So we have to find ways of improving in these areas specifically. The the second last bullet point, those are huge figures. I think that's the first thing you know. But in percentage terms, when you look at the overall number of officials, it's just below 2%. So in percentage terms, it's not a big figure. 242 disciplinary cases out of 50,000 is really not too many. But we're still concerned about it, not so much because of the figure, but largely the conduct. Again, we have that it's not going to be dominated. When we provide a breakdown later on, when we engage the committee going forward, the breakdown of disciplinary cases won't reveal necessarily that fraud so much. The other instances of corruption at the lower level in the court, these are not largely your national figures. It's activities of officials in the court, whether it's an official who gives somebody a document that they are not entitled to, maybe that the ministry of a particular case in exchange or it's somebody that tried to provide an extra service or a service that really should be provided for free, but for a fee. So some of the members of the public are not aware that they don't have to pay for certain things. So we find that now and again, when we get information from whistleblowers, that there's those types of activities going on. Or sometimes we find that people employ, relatives or their friends without going through the full procedure that they do it. So I think those are things for us that are of major concern. So we tend to take each case pretty seriously, and in many of these cases, we are coming to dismiss them. So we dismiss quite a lot of people on an annual basis. But those are the figures. 287 grievances, majority of whom relate purely to disputes around medical work. And we believe these really should be measures that get dealt with relatively simply. But I think because we encourage a culture of openness and transparency, we allow people to raise whatever issue of content by way of grievance if they so feel. And it changes from time to time. So this figure will go up because we are now in the phase where the performance assessment in the next 2 to 3 months is an assessment stage where the figures are going to be going high. But towards the end of the year, into the new year, those figures will have been fixed because most of these figures would have been resolved. On training, I think we don't have a problem on this one. A large number of officials get trained. We're trying to reach a target of 50% as much as possible. We should note that, with this particular area, it really is difficult. I think as the employer, we try to have as many people capacitated as possible. But, it has implications for service delivery. I think sometimes we get criticized the employer across the board in government that, people complain about service delivery and patient points. You don't want to be training so many people. You must remember that some of the training takes 2 to 3 days at a time. So it's not uncommon for people that can be workshopped. And we found it in our own assessment that too much training sometimes does get a disruption. But then people are not there because they're under corruption. So we are in the department looking at ways in which we can avoid having too much training. And I'm quite concerned if something called too much training. So for example, does it mean that just people come into committed to training that every person must go to training every week? I don't think it necessarily falls. If you've gone in a cycle of 2 to 3 years for good training once, there should be sufficient training in which you work. But it doesn't mean that every year you must attend some sort. Because it means basically that a large number of staff in a year are going to training. And we found that it does really have implications for service delivery when you look for people in the store that are in. So when we say we want to train at least 50% of our staff, it's in that particular context that not everybody will get training every year in each year. Strategic objective 3 around implementing sound financial management. We have improved in this area of unqualified money. One area where we expect that this year we should be the final year in which we get qualified in respect to the management of money in trust, and I can give that in greater detail as soon as we finish our PPP and start implementing it in the middle of this year or late this year. We're hoping that from the 2010-2011 financial year, we should be qualified. 3 years ago, when we came to the portfolio committee, we did indicate that this is the last year in which we expect some qualification. Although we made significant improvement in accounting for these figures, moving from disclaimers to at least a qualified opinion, as we're able to produce more financial information, you know, we think though that this is one area where it should end. And as a department, this is really the area that affects us the most. But in other areas where we find that we need to strengthen our financial control is with respect to supply chain management. And this doesn't necessarily mean that it's because of the corrupt practices. And I think I want to clarify it. It's not the point. It's because there would be one aspect of the procedure that's not complied with absolutely fully. So if you follow through the comments of the Auditor General, you'll find that it's not on the basis that, you know, and I'm glad that the department has reached this point where somebody gets, you know, corruptly allocated the same position. Allocated things that relate to great skills level in terms of improving the way English people understand procurement procedures and implementing them point by point as they should be. So we resolve those things through training. So I'm quite comfortable that we've moved quite a lot in the past 3 years. On page 9, strategic objective 5, that would be important. The department is able to produce quarterly reports on a quarterly basis. So for members of the committee, if you want to follow what the department did in the past financial year, there are 4 quarterly reports available that can be provided to you. They talk to every aspect of the department. So that assists us a lot in communicating what we need. Our affairs with the information technology as part of administration. With respect to on slide 10, strategic objective 7. The most important thing there is to analyze those audit projects that the audit committee are dealing with in both the national office and the FDA. So we want to make sure we sort out the issues around supply chain management that were picked up by those checking us and the asset measures. Audit reports will assure significant improvement in management of assets, which was a problem in the past financial year. So we think we've made great strides in that regard. The second bullet point around security, this is a challenge for the department, because what it does mean is that by and large, most of our courts don't have the type of security that we wish them to have. There are a few courts where you find CCTV cameras. There are many courts where you won't find CCTV cameras. You may find maybe one or two security guards there, but what you would want by and large is to improve the security level. And it is a challenge because this is one that is dependent on the availability of the budget. And over the past 3 years, we never had the adequate budget to fully implement. So we move on it as and when we have the resources available. Differentiated security provided to individuals who need security. So under those circumstances, we're able to provide security because the police provide their support and they've been doing a good job at. Slide 11, there aren't many details there, but the key activities here relate to mutual legal assistance and extradition measures. What basically happens is that the department being the central authority for the DG being the central authority for international cooperation, we do get requests from various countries for investigations to be done on certain identified individuals in South Africa by the relevant authority. The police and the NPA normally do that work for us depending on the matter, and the vice versa. So that's the work that likely gets done on mutual legal assistance and respect of cooperation. The other is with respect to extradition. If somebody should be extradited from South Africa or should be extradited to South Africa from another country, the NPA moved those applications on behalf of government to what it should be pursuant to criminal cases taking place. I mean, the one that is common on everybody listed to it. The Princeton case, which was the court. So there will be the type of process going on that the NPA can produce in the context, but that's part of the work that the National Office provides. The key of the department's work, the core only of our business, is from this slide, which is court services. We're still working with the department to break this down and clarify in its proper context, because what it talks to firstly, it talks to really all of the courts. The budget majority part goes towards services provided in the court, and it means the budget is broken down into 9 provinces, and our heads of justice in the various provinces then have the budget allocated to the various courts, and they provide services in those courts. But what it also deals with, what we deal with in this area, is formulation of policy. As you know, being a services department, we are driven by formulation of policy and then implementation. So we just wanted to highlight that program we put into change from next financial year to policy development and cost savings, because we feel that the way it currently reflects understates another critical point of policy formulation, which is key in the administration of justice. Specifically, what we are going to be doing in the next 3 years, in this year in particular, the second bullet point, or the first bullet point, I talked earlier about the challenges of infrastructure. Between now and 2011-2012 financial, we're going to be building 11 new courts. One of the things we are engaging and we are thinking about is really whether 11 new courts in 3 years is an adequate figure, looking at the challenges of administration of justice. If we conclude that it is not, and we want to build more courts, we then have to be alive and expect that, as I show later, the current budget of the department and capital work, especially this year, is about 450 billion. And to build a course is about 120 million. That's what it's going to cost us last year's price. So just to put 11 courts over the next 3 years, you're going to need a lot more than that. So clearly, we're going to be arguing that the committee assists us get a better allocation respect to this particular of our work. The other key program, which is currently underway, is one of converting at least 46 of the 280 branch courts into main courts. The way the South African courts are structured is that we have main courts in the key areas, like let's say Cape Town Magistrate Court, that's the main court. KwaZulu-Natal Magistrate Plain are not main courts, they are branch courts of the main court. So basically, courts in the, and this is part of the transformation agenda, courts outside of town were always seen as branch courts of the main court. So they're like subsidiary courts. So in terms of allocation of resources, all resources were historically allocated to the main court. And the branch courts were serviced by people traveling from the branch court. That's why the committee was seen during the course of the tenure. There were the issues relating to magistrates traveling from main court to branch court and claiming travel. It's purely because they leave home, go to the main court where the courts are, and then travel from the main court to the branch court to go and perform a service and go back. So we're trying to change it by ensuring that all of our courts are actually just main courts. Courts should be self-standing main courts in their own right and not the branch court of any other court. Then the resources must be allocated to this. So it's a transformation agenda that says that all courts are equal and all people that are serviced by the courts are equal, and therefore we shouldn't have a situation where certain areas are seen as being serious. The last bullet point around language affairs. As a pilot, we're focusing on 2 courts per province, but they were quite satisfied that this program worked very well and therefore should be rolled out completely in all of the courts. The implementation of legislation becomes an important thing. The implementation of the Child Justice Bill, which will come into effect in 2010, is important because the preparatory work has to start much earlier. It's already underway. It's familiar that the Child Justice Bill establishes a parallel criminal justice system for juveniles. So what it means is that once it's implemented, the criminal justice system, as you know, will not apply to juveniles. In other words, 18 years and below. The child justice bill will apply. That's the new criminal justice system for juveniles, and gas is the provision. So we are currently waiting to put in place those mechanisms. And they largely relate to personnel, ensuring that the inquiries that are provided for the inlet legislation will have people allocated to them to perform going forward. So we're working together with social development in that respect. Social worker is the key in those particular things. The child justice will also provide, well, not the child justice sector, also provide for diversion, trauma use of diversion as a mechanism. With respect to maintenance, I think that's work in progress. We're trying to improve on it as time goes on, and I think that one will be resolved largely by a close engagement with the judiciary, because many of those issues that arise out of maintenance payments relate to the way the court orders are structured or given. So we're trying to deal with it. The area that we'll have much pressure on is the family advocate. You know, the Children's Act, which is the legislation promoted by social development, provides chair for the children's inquiries in cases where they are divorcing. And the interest of the child, because they are separate from the interest of the two litigating parties, the court tends to want to report from family counselors and family advocates, independent reports, that vary as well as the interest of the child. So as many of these cases come up, we have pressure to provide this particular service. And because it's a free service, there's great demand for it. The challenge for us is that, again, from a personnel perspective, we don't have the resources to fully roll out this particular service. So it's one of the challenges around personnel that we're dealing with. The small claims court project has been completed. We do have a small claims court, and people are trained and are continuously being trained. What we now have to show is that this small claims court functions much more efficiently. So going forward in this committee, we should be statistics about how the case is progressed in the particular case. On slide 14, I've dealt slightly with those issues. The most important one here is the third bullet point from the top, the National Register for Sex Offenders. This flows out of the legislation generally referred to as the Sexual Offenses Act, the Criminal Law Amendment Act, but called the Sexual Offenses Act. What it provides for is that from the 1st of July, if my data are correct, we should start having a register for sexual offenders in terms of which everybody convicted of a sexual offense is placed on that particular register. So that prospective employers become aware of the people's record in this respect. We have gone a long way in establishing the register. In fact, it is ready. We just are now trying to comply with other areas of the legislation. But from the 1st of July, this will be running with that population. We started collecting some of the statistics about current conditions that we add on to that. So it should help when we deal with teachers, so that schools, you recall in terms of the legislation, people can call in and verify and audit and check if a prospective employee is registered or is registered with a sexual offense registration. And if the confirmation of that registration or listing, then the prospective employee is entitled to not employ the particular person. But despite the establishment of the register, we are ready for implementation. The other issue that should be ready also by then is the national policy framework for sexual offenses. The DG is on the intersectoral committee responsible for putting that policy together, asked me towards the end of this month to finalize and adopt a particular policy, after which it can be taken through cabinet through the appropriate structures of government, and that will become the new framework for dealing with sexual offences in South Africa. I've talked on the review of the civil justice system, has just commenced in NF, and they will be producing regular reports in that respect. The effectiveness of the criminal justice system pursuing the review and implementation of some of the recommendations, those that can be implemented immediately. That work in progress, and we can provide reports on an ongoing basis. was changing our services basically two areas. One is legislation, development of legislation and modern legislation. When you give the data on the program, we will facilitate a draft legislative program that talks to the legislation that we propose to, if accepted by the minister and the commission to push through the course of this year. There's a couple of interesting legislation, one of which is the human trafficking bill, which deals with human trafficking. The other influence to the review is the bill generally referred to as the DNA bill, which talks to the capacitation of the forensic capacity within the human trafficking. So just one of the bills that are there. All in all, I think it's about a quarter of between 12 and 15 bills that we can put in place for this year. So the commission has a very busy agenda. That's one aspect. The other aspect is the provision of litigation services through the state attorney's office and behalf of government as a whole. So that's really where the ongoing work can be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. I think I've dealt with these particular areas on page 16. The most important one for this committee is one which is in the public domain, it's open the business day to day, and there is one that is creating controversy around state liability. Pursuant to the Constitutional Court judgment in State v. Nyasi, you'll recall that the great concern raised in the Constitutional Court and publicly is that judgment debts are not certified by government. When government has an order granted against it in monetary terms, government takes long to pay the judgment creditor. And the current State Liability Act prohibits and prevents attachment of government assets to certify the judgment debt. So, for example, if you have a judgment in your favor of 100 million, you can't attach a government building for purposes of satisfying that judgment debt. It's prevented in law. And the Constitutional Court criticized the case in Yavi because a brief recall that was a paraplegic who was awarded $200,000 in damages against the NEC for health and housing. And that department took a long time to pay until the Kenyatta stopped giving benefits, executed the judgment. And when the student tried to execute against government assets, he was stuck in the state that was presented there from the NEC. So it created a problem, it became a constitutional case because then he argued clearly that his rights were not being violated. The judgment in favor of which government was not satisfied, and at the same time, he couldn't attach against government assets to satisfy the judgment. So the Constitutional Court gave government, I think we have until a day in July this year, to, I think July this year, to submit a progress report to the Constitutional Court on what has been done to give effect on a number of judgments that are currently granted against various government departments. The department through the State Attorney's Office has been keeping the various heads of various departments informed that they still have to satisfy some of the outstanding judgments. So we're trying to push to make sure that as much as possible all of that is done. At the same time, we've asked for an extension of the amendment to legislation to improve on the situation. The letter will be heard in August at the Constitutional Court because we are of the view that government will not be necessarily through with its passing of the amendment bill that seeks to address this particular problem. And that amendment, state liability amendment, is one of the legislation that will be proposed for this particular committee. So on the executive side, we're quite confident that we can get that bill onto the parliamentary agenda, but we're not certain that the parliament will be able to finalize its processes before the August day. So what we are going to the Constitutional Court to do is to ask for maybe an extension until early next year to enable all of the processes to go through. But the draft amendment bill is already in the public domain, and some of the comments around it are basically that it doesn't fully address what it sought to achieve. and the main point is that the amended bill still doesn't provide for an attachment of government assets, but rather strengthening the mechanism for execution, not for execution, but for payment of judgment debt. So the debate is about whether in principle there should be attachment against government assets. And the current proposal indicates that there shouldn't be an attachment. And I think the various committees are saying there should be an attachment for government assets. And I think that's something that we will go by this committee and the executive. So that really is the main issue, whether we should have a principle where you can attach it. The international practice is that you don't attach government assets for purposes of execution. So there's no reason why we should advocate them approach in this country. But what we have to address is how government can better, through stronger mechanisms, ensure that judgment, if not appeal, are able to the process. So we're trying to provide for that mechanism. I think the other issues are really not now the key. And there are specific issues, I think, that is what we focus on. On the budget, which is the thicker slide, I'll go very quickly to the breakdown, which is obvious. On page 4, you have a breakdown of the budget of the past 3 years of the department. The two most important things to note are that there has been a general increase in the department's budget over the past 3 years, since 2007, 2008, 2009. So we have been providing with resources to perform. I think whether it should be higher than that or more than that, something can be further discussed. But we have generally enjoyed a general allocation in that respect. And secondly, that you know we have also improved our under expenditure challenge. In 2006-2007, you can see there that we had a 472 million under spent. I remember engaging the committee explaining the various reasons, therefore, and how we're prioritizing underspend. And I think the main headline in the news on Sunday, I still remember it, because I know I can't do what it suggested. It said Justice Board is a good book. So the Sunday Times headline, 3 years ago. So that's done greatly. So we made sure that we never find an article like that again in the paper. So there's been an improvement in expenditure. So in 2007-2008, we only underspent 5 million, and last year we spent about 1 million. And that underspend is not really a core of what we are responsible for. That is work that is done jointly with the other departments. It's work that is done in an integrated way. So in other words, we can't spend on our area of activity unless the other departments in the cluster have also moved. So it's more where the integrated activity is going on. And I made an example to colleagues on this that, for example, it relates amongst us to the program that we run jointly in the cluster, the JCPS cluster with correctional services around audiovisual postponement, that the people are going to link up the core to the correctional center to run this effectively. Both of us have to be on the same page, and you know we move much faster than the correctional services were able to move, but then we couldn't spend because and buy the equipment for the court side because their side wasn't able. As a result, we didn't spend. So that's the issue. You know, we checked early this year about where they are, and you know, we're quite confident that by the end of this calendar year they would have finished our process. So they are moving pretty fast. Because part of the work involves breaking down the physical infrastructure. So they're spending a bit of time doing public work on board on their side. So that should go away during the course of this year. But on our areas, our core areas, you can see that we spend 99% of our budget. On slide 5 is a breakdown of the budget through the department. You see that item 2 accounts for a greater part of the allocation of our budget. So this will always be the case because this is really our core business, which is the course that I indicated earlier. So a large chunk of our budget goes to the course. And it also goes to program 4, which is the National Prosecuting Authority, the 2.1 billion. So both of those account for about 5.5 billion of our 8 billion budget. It makes sense, it is straightforward. The cost, the resulting in the cost, is the NPA prosecution, which is the core of our services. So for purpose of implementing the government program, especially with respect to the criminal justice system, the NPA is the core for this particular department through the prosecution and the police of the investigation of cases. But this department also has to be on the NPA, the prosecution arm of government. So therefore it makes sense that you see that the allocation of the budget is appropriately to those particular areas. It's in the court. You then see that the 1.5 billion goes to what is 10 auxiliary and associated services, which as the breakdown shows there is to those Chapter 9 institutions. The largest allocation going to the legal aid board. And again, it makes sense because if you look at the work that the NPA does around prostitution, there's a corresponding service provided by the legal aid board in criminal defense. And their budget is under the J8. What we have been engaging with the legal aid board, and we hear this from them, is whether or not their allocation is proportionate to the NPA allocation. Because really what's supposed to happen is that the more cases that they bring on board in each case, they're supposed to be a legal aid person also providing defense to their accused person. So there is an argument that we should look favorably at the department to increase or a greater allocation to the legal aid board to try and bring it as close as possible to the NPA level. So they throw a direct comparison in what they do with the NPA. Except that we should be reminded that the NPA is also not only about just the NPA, which is the prosecution case. There are other activities that the NPA performs, which consume a lot of resources in themselves, like the anti-corruption and so forth. So that's the breakdown of the budget, and at the bottom there is a breakdown towards the judiciary. The judge's salary is 370 million, and we spent more, 504 million. Really, I don't think we should be too concerned about that expenditure. It's more than budgeted. I think it's difficult to budget for because it's hard to predict what happens during the course of the year. We try and always budget according to the immediate past year's expenditure trends. But in any one financial year, there may be an increase in case loads that are put to the court. We can't not have cases put to the court. So we hear another expenditure where necessary. There'll be an appointment of more acting judges, that type of thing, and therefore more resources. And we simply balance it out at the end of the financial year with some of the money that may be available. So I think we should actually speak as a positive more than a negative, because it just means there's more cases going through the system. Magistrate salaries, you can see there that there's been an increase in expenditure for the same reason. On slide 6, economic classification. Most of our money, you'll see on the first point, goes towards compensation of employees. We are a services department. Our core of our budget goes towards remuneration of people. It's as simple as that. You won't find a lot of other things that maybe you find in other departments. We don't have industries or plants and all those types of things. We have purely a few performing services. So, compensation of employees takes a large part of our budget because we pay people's salary. So that change then shows why 3.8 billion goes towards them. Then we have goods and services, which is the third point there, 2.8 billion. And basically that's the equipment that people use to perform the service, with computers, with printers, so forth. Sometimes it does also include use of consultants for policy documents and other services that are provided. So a lot of that goes there. And the other one that I think must be noted is the 1.2 billion towards department agencies and accounts and municipalities. That's the money that we pay to other government departments for services that are provided to the department, in particular Department of Health for psychiatric services. But the accused person sometimes leaves and send it to the court they have to go for psychiatric observation, and the Department of Health provides those services for them, and then they have to pay on an ongoing basis. Those are some of the services that get provided to us. The one that I mentioned earlier around cost infrastructure, the 423 million that's talking about the construction of the court, that's a very small amount, and we will be engaging with the executive and our minister to engage with the committee to try and assist us to get a bigger slice of that budget if we're going to be rolling out services. The rest of the slides, Chairperson and members, really just show it, how this is broken down. On slide 7, this is important because what it shows is that the two lines going up, one with the ring there, the top 206, 207, with a huge March spike, so it means we decided to spend a lot in February and March, which was a concern from an auditor's perspective. The other line that also goes up is for 207, 208, so it's pretty consistent. We're still putting in place our system there for better management of our budget. And in this past financial year, you see that it's actually a downward line. So we didn't have a much budget as well. So we spent more time in months 7 and 8, as you can see. That's where the biggest curve is or the biggest gap. So in other words, we try as much as possible to reprioritize any and start spending any around mid-year, September, October, so that we don't have a much budget. So I think that's something important that should be noted. On 8, I think we should set a breakdown of what I've said here, but the most important thing is the third bullet point that talks to the OSD, an issue that is predominant in the media. And for us, the challenge is that we have to absorb the cost of implementing OSD within our baseline budget. We did not get additional budget allocation from National Treasury. We had to implement the agreement reached in favor by government backdated to 1 July 2007, but with no corresponding allocation. So we're asked to use our baseline budget. We have to find close to 300 million rand in our baseline budget. So we did suspend government. It was a very painful exercise at the department, ourselves, the National Office, the NPA, the Legal Aid Board, debating how much and what areas to not spend on, just so that we can comply with it, to avoid industrial action. We haven't completely excluded the possibility of industrial action, but the fact that we're able to do something, we've been able, and we're fortunate that now we're not facing the difficulties that the other departments are facing. But unless we get specific allocations to remedy this, we can't do it as completely. So we will be engaging with this committee for assistance in this regard. The other area where we're able to allocate money to provide unfunded services are in the second last bullet point area. I've indicated OSD is one of the meeting meetings. We also provided guarding services, provided money to the master's office, and a couple of other areas with some of the reallocations. The allocations per se are not a problem. I think they've served us very well because we've run the full organization budget almost on reprioritized funding. I think for us it just indicates better use of our budget, but by and large, for OSD though, if you want to argue that we should be given a separate allocation and we should use our baseline budget. I wish to not go through the rest of the slide here. There's just a repetition of the various things that I've raised. If, for example, you go to slide 14, slightly different, page 14, you see the different lines. The top line, which is the sharper ascent, is cost services. What it basically says is that we allocate more of our budget towards cost services for reasons that I've explained to you. It's our core area of our business. So naturally, it should grow like that. The second one, the one with the cross, that's the NPA. So for prosecution services, we have to have that line going up there. So that pretty much makes sense. So when it comes to the other auxiliary services, what you should expect, the line going up is the legal aid board line as well. So the top should be common theme. The court, the NPA, prosecution, which is the core category for criminal defense code. So that's very vital for this department there to go. So for both, we're training in the right area. That's a big thing. The program, program one, the increase in spending is in with respect to corporate services. And those two lines, they cross the corporate services as a whole, but specifically office accommodation, because we've been employing more people, we've been building our services, so we needed accommodation to place people in. So we actually started this financial year with a 65 million deficit in there. As soon as we got an allocation, so we're paying more for it. This is a different point. It's not a good idea for government to have to build an disposal for which it doesn't pay as opposed to paying them. But you find that across the board in government, the general class for government for rent from private place. And then get tenants, many of the services provided are pretty much dependent on the landlord. If you have a good landlord, it's pretty much a good deal. But if you don't have a good landlord, you spend more time fighting about the state of the building, how it should be kept. So something to think about. So we're spending a lot of money on rental. And I imagine that it's much better to come to the own building to rent. So that just shows on the administration side where most of our money is spent. For any reason other than the fact that there's not much operation that's going on, and the budget in the ministry is actually quite constantly low. I think it's quite correct. Slide 21, that big here is the star lighting up the issue, it's the lower cost, so that's where money is. So on the 3 billion or so that we get towards cost services, you can see that it goes to the lower cost. Most of our utilities take place in the lower cost. The debate on the judiciary in this country is focused on, in my view, any significant area, which is the high cost. Most of our criminal cases don't take place in the high cost at all. 98-95% take place in the magistrate. And that's the biggest area of our budget allocation. And yet the chief court and the judiciary is focused on the high court. The bill of the machine, maybe it's because of the strength of the high court. In fact, when you refer to the judiciary, but not us, many of you refer to the judiciary, you actually talk about the high court. They exclude magistrates when actually they are part of the judiciary. So when you talk about the judiciary, you should actually be talking to both the high court and the law. So it's something to note so that you can start focusing on that. But from an expenditure perspective, this correctly shows that that's where we spend most of our money and correctly, so otherwise there's a problem. And I think on page 22, you can see the further breakdown. If you see the budget for the lower court, it's 2.6 million. So all of the cost budget, 2.6 million goes to the lower court, and only 229 million goes to the high court. And then the Supreme Court of Appeal has its own budget of 15 million, and constitutional court is 68 million. That's the constitutional court has a higher budget than it should, relative to the work that is done. That's something you should have. I think it's way too high. You should get greater value for the amount of money. I'm not, I think I'm arguing for something that this committee can think about. So if you look at the breakdown of the budget, and you want to be critical about allocation of resources relative to the value that you receive, I think we need to start engaging with this type of issue so that we can be properly critical without raising issues of, I think there has been raised in the media for potential undermining. I think these are the issues we debate and the responsibilities. So that's the breakdown of the allocation to the court. I'm not going to spend too much on 23, so we break down legal services. The biggest spend naturally being in legal services towards the markup of the high court, because it's yourself, no one can remember the high court. So of the public that goes to the master of hospital, another 70 million points of that's why there's a huge spike. The second one, which we should start thinking about quite seriously and should be concerned about, is the one around litigation. I think for the next 5 years, there's going to be a lot of innovation in our course for a number of reasons, and there's going to be a huge trend. So we need to start assessing what we're being litigated against or on, what policy issues, and what we need to do. You'll note that there's been a great increase in constitutional litigation, and our constitutional court is quite a big court. I'm certain that it was 5 months in the but quite a big court. And you know, the government is going to think about it. So there's greater pressure. Some colleagues say there's going to be a lack of lawfare instead of the office. It's something to think about. I will give it 24. With respect to the NPA on slide 25, colleagues will view this later when they present, but I think it's just carrying through the theme. As you can see, that the line with the sharpest curve is the prosecution term. The majority of the employees in the NPA, and that's the core problem of government, especially big government, which are demanding to achieve on the sector. That's the core of the partner to achieve that particular approach. So naturally, it should have a much higher budget. The other areas that remain generally consistent with a marginal increase with respect to support services, which is a consistent function. The other areas that remain relatively consistent, so nothing to worry about. And further provided slide 26. Slide 27. Naturally, as I said, the sharpest graph going up is the legal aid board. For the reason that I stated here, that I want to keep there. The second one has been spending on the integration of the justice. As part of the review as well, we're trying to ensure that the greater use of technology, we don't have time on it, with the justice, but it goes through to the NPA, it goes through to the legal aid board, and so forth and so forth. So that accounts for that greater spending over a period of time, notwithstanding the 81 million underspend that I mentioned. The rest of the areas remain pretty much consistent and consistently low. I think maybe when those institutions come and present, the point that they'll be making is that possibly part of their performance, however you measure it, if you measure it as not being adequate, could be attributed to a consistently low allocation. If there's an increase, it's a marginal increase. So they very well argue that with a better allocation, they could perform a better job. So it may just be seen as a reflecting of the way in which those data are approached, low allocation. So there may be an argument that we increase allocation. And something to think about. In 2018, we can see that of those, the legal aid board has 49% of the budget. So 50%, half the budget, that goes to the 11% that goes to the legal aid board. So the Commission on Gender Equality, they keep 2.8%, they argue for greater allocation. The Rights Commission argues for greater spending, and so forth. So something to think about. And there's a decrease in that one to your left, the Office for the Control of Interception and Monitoring and Communication. There should be a decrease in this. But I think there isn't so much going on there as far as interception is concerned. So the network is working in normal way. 29, the sharpest share is the lower cost mixed state salary has gone up. The Commission for Public Office Bearers issued a report which was accepted by the President of the salary. Immediately went up. So for magistrates, that was a sharp increase. There was an increase for the higher cost position, but not as sharp as the magistrate position. So the consequence of this is that we should see a greater vacancy rate in the prosecution service because the commission and the magistrate commission includes themselves in the prosecution service. So whenever there's an increase on the magistrate side, the prosecution service also tends to want to be that particular area for that reason. With OSD, you are hoping to care for so that it shouldn't be necessary. So that those are the balances and the things that we're trying to put together. Key observation, by taking the feeling of hope, There are huge vacancies, you said to that point, huge vacancies in the magistrates in Indonesia. If we're going to deal with the crime situation, then we need to find a way of improving the particular across the board, you know, from national department to the MPA to the judicial, to the necessary vacancies, especially in the minority of them that we have seen, so that if the ventilation post in the management of money and trust, as Sasha Taylor, work that we're doing. What is a general support? I think we have more time, we can get through the details. The second bullet point is key as well as the story of Champion. Cost infrastructure and accommodation for prosecutors. We don't have money for this, but we want to start arguing for a budget that this is allocated. I think it's a pretty high budget. Chair, my proposal to not go through the rest. It's really a repetition of what I've gone through, but in just greater detail about where the money is going within each of those areas. There is nothing particularly big that I want to think about. Mainly on slide 37, on page 37, the reduction of the criminal case backlog. We have an allocation of 200 million, and it's broken down in that way. The MPA is 180 million, the department is 2 million, legal aid board 20 million. We've had an internal discussion with the department to say maybe we can look at the 72 million allocated in the department for policy and other things, and take some money down to the MPA and the legal aid board and the judiciary of the group to just put a dedicated focus where the which is the court, and let the national police just maybe concentrate on monitoring and evaluation. So I think it's important to see that there is a dedicated allocation for one which is not just like that. And there is something that is in the time that is monitoring. 38, we are about facilities management. The point I made here is that it's too low for us to be running our systems and we want. So we need to look at the network. Let the budget slightly manage for us by public works for purposes of construction. And 41, those are areas where we've managed to, through squeezing our budget, to release more money. We don't believe it. Allocation for everything that we want. And if there are any unfunded priorities, then through operations we discover that they are quite urgent and can't be postponed. We look at areas where we can save on the budget and not specifically just to save some money, and once we have some money, we allocate. So those are areas where we need them and we allocate this money to them. For example, the second bullet point, fully funded to cover the various lawyers and departments. That particular work, language services, risk management, security, for the collective. Chair, I'd like to propose to end there. But those notes will help you understand the data that you want to say, particularly to the executive.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Your hands are up already. I wish to apologize for not reminding you. So, let's proceed.
Transfers that can May I ask where you think kind of allocation for individual systems? I'm curious about your question on the TRC. How much money is left to bring this fund once the TRC goes on there? And what do you mean when you say for reparation purposes? Are these the community reparations as opposed to the individual identified? On the question of the master's office in the publication, and where I was very glad to hear that the transition had been made from manual systems to electronic. However, I've only last night received a letter from an attorney asking to please do not ask you to introduce permission to investigate the office of the master. Without wanting my court, and really, sir, I'm to be very sad. If one wants to, I won't go in. But if one wants to change the trustee of a trust, then so far from being electronic and manual, somebody has burdened the ball for storage facility in the same building as actually one is only the Indian branch. I can go down to the second one, the main method. And so it goes on and on. And so I'm going to an issue with this information. But and there's stuff about people, all attorneys now keep copies of all their teachings, because you must assume that your teachings will be nice. That's a single sentence of him to have those teachings, right? 1,500 pages, which will last 6 hours. So how far along the track is it in this conversation? And may I ask one last thing? On the matter of the 18th of the deadline, let me just say that I think that that judgment does create quite a challenge. But may we hope that by the time the department and the ministry bring the amendment to state liability to us, that we will no longer be trying to amend the constitution in a way which fundamentally alters the structure, in a way which I believe you have only one time to please, it must be possible to do this very challenging thing of changing the constitution. Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Minister. Just a few things that I picked up from the last presentation that we went through. And one of the things is that, things are made terribly technical. The problem with it is on the ground level, it's not brought to truth, and it's not brought to truth our leadership courts, it's not brought to truth our high courts, and it's not brought to truth our municipal courts. Now, there's a huge budget that's been made available for these new courts. But if one looks at the backlog in the Victoria High Court, the Victoria Magistrate, which are two of the busiest courts in the country, you will be lucky to get a court date for the leadership court in 2012. Now, then we hear that there are 70 magistrates that haven't been booked. Why haven't they been opposed before? If they've been open for 3 years, certainly someone must now be held accountable for the non-filling of their post. Because it's the South African rates and taxpayers that suffer as a result of these posts not being booked. And two, where the problem comes in is especially in a case where it's a civil financial claim. Because what the claim is worth 1 year, by the time the issue comes to court, the claim should double the state. So people are constantly moving out, and I do think it's now time someone can hold accountable to the state that we are 70-80 states that are still open. Then on the access for justice for all, I'm sincerely hoping the special children's court will include things that are required by legislation, such as video cameras for children to testify, and the fact that legislation is passed not only in this committee but in other committees, but then the Justice Committee actually doesn't implement what is required of it by legislation, and it's always important to be told that there are funds to use it. Clearly, also, the modernizing of the information technology, my colleague touched on it slightly. But I heard that 95% of the rollout is starting. As someone who's done articles, I have yet to see any court which is encrusted in great encrusted area, actually uses the scaling system. And I, for one, can personally testify to the fact that it is now known that if you take a court file, or you make a full copy of it, which you give yourself and others personally to get to the opposing party, because it is known that the files will disappear. But I have never seen any kind of scaling, bar the fact that they scan documents at the depot. But also, with regard to legal aid, I'm very glad to see legal aid is getting a lot of money. But there's one fundamental problem with legal aid, and that is legal aid is only accessible to the absolute poorest of the poor. Now, well, this is obviously a good thing. One must understand that there are people like teachers who earn dismal salaries. And a young woman teacher, for example, cannot go to the legal aid board to acquire legal aid for getting divorced, because she earns just that much too much to acquire legal aid. So what happens is, you know, a woman will stay in a marriage in this kind of circumstance because she earns too much to actually get legal aid, but she earns too little to go to a normal estate. So the catch-22 situation with regards to who is allowed legal aid, and that goes to the same with the legal aid to university, which they work together in parallel with each other. And that's a very, very big problem. Then another thing, strategic objective 23, where we talk about the master courts and how they deal with the rolling out of debt and things like that. But the problem is that 95% of South Africans will die in 6 days. And they die in 6 days because there is no one and no department and no structure that South Africans can go to acquire a debt. Now, we live in a country where a large majority of our population is illiterate, and a large majority of our population simply cannot afford to go to an attorney or a bank to do a book. Now, certainly, I've spoken about for years and years and years, in fact, for 10 years now, that the department has been set up to help people ensure that they do not die in these states and take into account indigenous law practice, so that this kind of problem can be rooted out. And if you go down to the grassroots level and sort it out to the bottom, then coming up, you wouldn't have to wait 4 or 5 months before you need to go see the master's office. And then my very last point, when it comes to training, I absolutely agree. I don't think it's necessary for people to be trained 5 or 6 hours in a 5-year period. But I strongly, strongly suggest that an immense amount of training needs to be done specifically with registrars and clerk support. Because these are people who their actions fundamentally influence the way a court case will run. And if a clerk or a registrar doesn't know what they're doing, the case is doomed from the very beginning. And, you know, it's well known in magistrates and in high court cases. You go there, if you want something done by the clerk of the court quickly, you give them a box of chocolate where you take them over, take the victim, and you hope that that will get your file put together properly. And really, you're in a whole lot of trouble for a registrar or a clerk to get the money. So it's the professionalization of services. And that's where money, you know, training money needs to be spent. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to just start by, at the beginning of the meeting, I referred to concerns about the in-depth discussion. And if we look at the previous committee's report, ICRO and ICRO report, they suggested quarterly meetings with the department, and that maybe that's something that we can look at. The DC did refer to giving us quarterly reports, but what was envisaged there was a quarterly briefing. If at least I understand the year's already passed, but if we possibly look at that, because there are a huge number of issues that have been raised this morning, and that time does not give us proper justification, or we can't do justice to looking at those issues. But I want to just touch on one or two. And bearing in mind, this is a report by a previous committee. But once you, it was circulated to us, and maybe I just suggest to the DC that he looks at that committee report and answers it in writing a lot of the issues that were raised, should you, Chair, agree with that. For example, we touched on the issue of the criminal justice review, which the DC touched on this morning. One of the suggestions made was that the overall should be accelerated and that key proposals, even if still tentative, should be brought before the parliamentary committee. and this is in February, I would really like to hear, we hear that things are going ahead, but I would like to see these proposals coming before us as soon as possible, because it is a huge impact, and as we know, fighting crime is an apex priority for the government. Then, just to move on to the budgeting aspects, and I'd like to touch on my colleague touched on, and that is the issue of the Scorpion budget. Could we get an indication, and possibly later it might be covered as well, but how many officials have applied to the new unit, and what are the budget implications of that? That would be very interesting. And what will happen to those that haven't applied? What will be the budget implications of that? And then, DG, you touched on the issue of the tenders, and with respect, you seem to gloss over the issue that there weren't any problems with the tendering process. But you might recall the whole issue of the Siberia Group, that was a major issue. And our report in February this year indicated that you could see that there may be systemic problems in the award of tenders that require addressing. Now, that was generally spoken. And we were advised that there is an internal committee dealing with the matter. Now, that is the matter of tenders in general. So it does seem that there is still an issue there that our report needs further clarification on that. And then if I may share, just as a last, just on the two bills that were referred to, besides the state liability bill, obviously the DMA bill is very urgent. That was referred to an ad hoc committee in January and wasn't finalized due to various problems, probably our own fault as parliamentarians. But could I just ask as to when are we going to see that bill before us? Is it going to be a joint meeting with us and please? And how quickly can that be finalized? It was raised in the State of the Nation Address by the ACDP, was responded to by the Minister of Police, saying it was being dealt with urgently. And clearly the human trafficking bill is also very urgent in view of the World Cup next year. And many of our constituents from the ACDP are asking what's happened with that bill. Thank you, Chair, quite a mouthful, but there are so many issues. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you,
mine is really, if you take the strategic plan and the strategic objectives, you know, the objective, what is intended is quite laudable, but what would be really useful to see is how. If you take, for example, first one, I think some people have already alluded to it, reducing the vacancy rate. How would that be done? How has the vacancy rate, how has it stood over the past 2 years? So the vacancy rate now, the 2,741, is that less than this time last year? Or is it more, is it going up, or is it going down? But basically, I think the main issue would be more detail as to how these strategic objectives are going to be achieved. Then I wanted to ask specifically about the Limpopo and Mpumalanga High Court. Where are we with funding for the building of those courts? So I think at that stage those are the main questions.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, I think my issue of this is around the structure of the management court. It is not very crystal clear what is it exactly responding to. It may be the end. Something that is responding to which is not appearing in the slide, but which meant it to someone. And that's the first question. And the second issue is I'm trying to grapple with the planning model that is being followed. If you talk of a planning model, for instance, you would be you would be looking at your planning levels, your KE levels, and and what is the object of change. So I think the critical issue that we need to spend time on is to always think whether you're building core, whether you train managers, and why you provide transport to whoever. What is the central object of my change? At the end of the day, at the end of each strategy goal, what we want to evaluate is how these activities have impacted on the object of our economic change. It hasn't come out very, very clear. And for instance, if we say in your strategy goal 1, access to justice for all, I know it's a very popular term, but I think what's critical is then what. When that access is what is the object of our change. Because people might have access to justice. But when we do evaluation at a particular strategic point, we're not evaluating access. We're checking what has that access done. And in my understanding, therefore, see, that would be a strategic goal, but not access itself. Because our interest is what does that access do? What is our object of change? And again, what is also an issue with me is that as we try to grapple with the model that is being followed, is that you've got 3 strategic goals and you've got 25 strategic objectives. And one doesn't know now, if you look at those strategic objectives, which strategic objectives relate to which strategic goal. The reason I'm raising this thing is that I think for us to be able to critique the department effectively, the language we use, the planning system should be commonly understood. Because if it is not, whatever we say about the resource allocation is not going to make any sense. If, for instance, you talk about strategy goal 1, access to justice, the question is that if you talk about that at the planning level, at what time and in what manner must it have been achieved? After 4 years, 5 years, what do we need after 3 years? What is it that when we do evaluation, we should say, if indeed the object of change, which is targeted by this access, has been what we call, has been positively what we call impacted upon. what especially I'm trying to speak about is the order of issues. That really is a problem with me. And, for instance, I heard you say it's important to, when we spend, it doesn't matter whether we spend in court, to actually talk about the value for which we spend. And that value for which we spend can only be measured against a clearly defined object of change and how we impact on that by all these sort of activities.
For instance, if you go to strategic goal, in strategic goal 2, among the other bullets there is the prudent management of department's finances in planning, implementing strategic planning.
I think the question there is, why do we call that element of a strategy what we call goals? Because naturally, those are the things that are supposed to be done on day to day to advance the major issue. Why would we sit as a committee and actually say, yes, this is the goal that we spend years, maybe, or this is the strategy.
What I'm trying to do, you will assist me if you want to respond. Maybe I'll try and understand better, because what I'm grappling with is in the order of these issues, especially the 25 sidewalks that you've related to three sidewalk codes. And because if you talk sidewalk objectives, you will agree with me that's a lower level than
a sidewalk code. Then a sidewalk objective must, actually target a particular sidewalk code. And then in this instance, which side of the thing are targeted?
Which side to go? Probably when you come, when you respond in that model of planning, one will actually be able to raise more sensible and logical questions. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I tend to agree with Steve Smart that we should consider providing using Kamani with the summary analysis which was conducted by Chinese. There's a mountain of software that requires attention and that we ask the providers to respond to this. We don't have the time now. In a lighter vein, Chip, I think JJ whispered to me and GG raised the question of renting buildings instead of buying properties. So in between, JJ says, well, if you rent buildings, then they don't pay cash. And while I understand the need for us to amend the state liability law, you'll recall in the not so recent partnership, we switched to the book. We actually spent time in South Africa and was involved in an action that rendered him a cabbage. The court ruled in his favor and he was awarded an absolute. And my understanding is that it rendered the RAS virtually back. Long comes in Sanyasi. Well, I'm assuming that it was. There was no appeal. Okay. Long comes in Sanyasi is awarded 200,000 yen. And suddenly there's all kinds of problems. I would imagine, Chair, that is where the problem lies. We need to ask the state, but why aren't you paying the Swiss and other people like you? If you pay the Swiss gentleman with such unfamiliarity, that is where the problem actually lies. I accept that there may be a need to amend the state liability structure. I just thought I needed to raise that ahead of the table of the contract. Chairperson, an important part of these deliberations pertain to the Auditor General's report. Now, I've just quickly glanced through the report as it pertains to the department. There's cause for concern because he raises some worrying issues here. And I wondered whether DG Simulani couldn't address some of those issues there. He may have already done so to the previous committee, and if that is the case, then I'm willing to step back. But I really would like him to address some of the very serious issues he raises in the report.
Thank you very much. I think one thing that it is one, after which we must come out of given but it should be along the lines of another meeting pursuing the same and so on, the real critical issue.
that are able to deal with the government.
Thank you very much, Chair and the members, for this question. I've just circulated a document marked Access to Justice Draft MTSF. I think it will address some of the concerns that Mr. Kombula is facing around some of the planning, because as I indicated here, the first thing that I presented was more a general high level. So this one will then give you the details of each, the date and the when and the when and the what. It will help, but I'll still deal with the question. With respect to the first question around the DSO allocation, what's been decided is that the number of the DSO officials that are moving to the police, that is a clear concern to Mr. Mbuti, the budget for those who move with them. Those that have declined to move, or those that are not moving, or the remaining behind, pending finalization of other things, their budget will really remain where it is in the NPA, or will move to wherever other that they may be allocated. For example, if there's a few, let's say 50, that are allocated to the SIU, that's the other state department to which they are sent, the budget for them will move corresponding number to the SIU. So that there's always a budget for them. So there won't be a situation where people move and there's no budget accommodating them. So their budget will move along those lines. I'm not sure that it is this committee that will do this. I think it can be provided a breakdown on the figures and all of that stuff, but I think it's just going to be a normal change in the budget. When it happens, when it happens. The actual modalities, I think, is something we can look at, because when the budget vote, I think, gets allocated, the question is should it be allocated with the DSO budget here. In terms of the legislation, the date when, if I remember correctly, the DSO ceases to exist on the justice side of the vote, I think it's the 4th of July, 5th or 6th of July. So if the budget vote goes through before then, in terms of the law, it has to be with the DSO on this side. And then when the transfer happens, there'll then be an arrangement with the treasury to invest on those funds. Because in law, they are still part of the justice vote until such time that the 5th of July date comes in terms of the amendment legislation. I think there must be a mechanism to share in terms of the PFMA and through trade regulation to effect those types of changes when there was an assignment in change. But that is not, the issue of the budget is not a major concern. I think we're able to resolve it at the last meeting that took place between the ministers and the officials. I think maybe I'm getting sure on the latest figures, if you have the figures there, I think there are the requested figures. Thank you.
The last figures was just we had 187 members agreeing to or consenting to go to SAS and 58 declining to go to SAS.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. That will address the DSO men. But from 5th of July, there will then cease to be the DSO within the NPA and the justice vote. And then start operating formally in terms of the legislation. With respect to the JSC allocation is located in the Office of the Chief Justice's allocation, which is within the Constitutional Court budget. So that's where it is found. And also the JSC is managed from there. The department and the ministry just provide the secretarial support. You are correct with respect to the TRC method. That what that includes is the President's Fund, and the matter collection in the President's Fund is at 700 million or so there. And the regulations that have been sent to Cabinet seek to deal with, like I've just advised, with interest, the figure has gone up to about 900 million now. Those reparations, those regulations deal with the reparations, which go to the spending of that money, and it largely includes community reparation. So the money couldn't be spent until such time that there was an agreed framework, and those cabinet memoranda, those different methodologies, if approved, would then allow for the funding to be spent according to those particular projects.
Yes,
the community reparations, so they were related to things like health, education, amongst others. And we managed to get input from those departments. So that matter should now relatively move smoothly. With respect to the master's office, I'll tackle the master's office together with the civil staff. In the presentation, what I was saying was, we spent a lot of time just dealing with the criminal, and we've concluded the criminal. We've not just started with the civil staff. So you may not have seen the scanning during the course of last year, because we're still developing the system for it. What is now being done is they've gone out on the app as well. So with time, that should also disappear for the civil network. The way we've dealt with the criminal court. So you won't see an immediate improvement, I think, in the next 6 months or so, because now we're only running out of the system. But it has now been developed, and it's designed to work exactly the same way. So people will bring their files, they will be scanned, and they'll be kept electronically fast. And then if people want to have access to the file, we develop a procedure for them to access the file, and so forth and so forth. So that aspect of the work is going to be done. I'll not encourage, just like in the zoo, we're not encouraged to feed animals. I wouldn't encourage that you give people biscuits to perform a service, because it's inappropriate. In fact, we are encouraging the practice. I think it's much better to report people that engage in that type of practice, because it's actually quite easy, because we know at any one point in time in each court, there's only one service. So we know who it is. If there's a problem with an individual or a civil clerk, we'll know exactly who it is. So it's not a situation where there's a couple of clerks and we don't know. So there's only one, and most there's two. So if there is a problem in that specific court, then we really would wish to know. I've personally intervened in the Joburg South Court and actually visited, and there's a much greater improvement. I must say that part of the problem is occasioned by attendance, because of the manner in which they interact with the court. I suppose because of some of those frustrations, people have a way in which they want to always keep up to date with the files, and they collect the files, and they make amendments to the files and put other documents and remove them without necessarily reporting back to the clerk of the court what has happened. So we try to streamline that. For example, one of the procedures that we've invoked there, which has helped us, is that people must now request in writing in advance if they're going to be accessing a file, so that we can look for it in advance, and then when they come to court, they don't wait, it's already ready. And what we found that as soon as there's a type of procedure, it decreases the request, all of a sudden. So we found that it's not just a practice in the court, there are practitioners that benefit from the chaos in the system, because those are the people maybe that then spend time trying to solicit favors and trying to get their matters in the court roll first, which is part of the problem. The second then part of the problem relates to just the time it takes to get a trial date. I think on average, in the criminal court, I think it's close to 18 months to get a trial date in the regional court and the high court. It could be slightly less now. But in the civil court, it takes just as long, if not slightly more, to get a trial date. One, because there is just so many cases. We're just so litigious now. With the constitution, South Africans are suing each other left, right, and center, basically. So there's a huge volume. And therefore, the courts are trying to keep pace with that particular level of litigation. Almost every matter just gets litigated upon. And then once, obviously, parties litigate, remember that in civil matters, the state is not involved. It's private parties, and the state is just facilitating the process. So the control of the litigation is at the hand of the parties. What we have seen and picked up with the judiciary is that many of the cases that eventually get called on roll call are actually not ready to hear, are not ready for trial. So we are engaging with the judiciary to say, you see, that is now the part of the system that the judiciary is in absolute control over. So there's really not too much by way of intervention that the executive can do, because it's now a court process. Once the parties are before the court, it's now before the court. We've been engaging with the judiciary to see if there are ways in which the judiciary can put the parties under pressure to bring the litigation up to speed. And one of the things that, as part of the review, the rules board is dealing with is exactly that, to say how to make sure that people, yes, they can exchange pleadings and file papers, but then the judiciary directs the pace with which parties bring litigation. Because eventually parties will have to get a summons issue. And then the exchange of pleadings, they do at their own pace. And there's no rush. And then the lawyers try to settle matters, and then they, well, the court system is just stuck with this particular matter. So what you have is an abuse by those with money of a public space, which is the court, and other people that don't need court for desperate matters, don't have use of the court, because those with the means and the sense, you know, dominate the space and are monopolizing. So saying, in effect, if you have the money to litigate, and you can keep the court under pressure, that you're privatizing what is otherwise the public space. So the only way to unlock the type of pressure is if the court takes, through the judiciary, takes greater interest in those measures and a set up court rules and court practices to unlock the particular process. So it's important in that respect to bear in mind that it will be done in that way. So for instance, the master's office, similarly, the point is that no, we won't have a commission of inquiry. I think it's not necessary. Communal court will always have the results. We always hope for it's unpredictable. So we need to do something that we know we want to achieve. This is a problem in the master's office, which we have also resolved, and shouldn't be a problem. You know, people find papers and they want to amend deeds of trusteeship. Because of the minor system, you do have instances where, you know, people do lose fast, they lose shares. You know, I'm quite confident that they're able to address. But you do have, in a way, I think, ongoing challenges with efficiency of officials, which you can address through training at some point, but you pretty much can't do that if it continues. So what we have done, because really the point around trustees is just the issue of the amended trust deed, is that, again, we've developed a system which we're going to be now piloting with the private sector, where we're going to make them do a large chunk of the work. So we've got the various forms in electronic format. They're available in PDF format. So you can access our website as we speak. If you're here, go to our website, you'll be able to see them. And what we're trying to encourage is the legal practitioners to fill them in themselves with the details, the avoid problems of spelling and all those types of things. Then they print them out and then they can submit them. And then all the officials in the matter can put a stamp and submit them. And then it's issued. So that's one way in which we're hoping that this can be done. So the system is developed, is ready, and it is available for use. It's not just a question of rolling it out. I think, yeah, I must say that, you know, part of the challenge is that, you know, we can't do all of these things at the same time. You know, and our past 2-3 years, we've been focusing on the criminal side. Now we're moving on the civil side, and we'll also move on the master side. But I think we should be able to complete this exercise, and I think during the course of the year, the committee can request a report on each specific item, and then we'll be able to provide those specific things. But if there are individuals that still have problems, it's better to refer them to us, and then we can go and look at their specific circumstances, and then try and move that as fast as possible, especially if it's those two offices, and those are the two biggest offices. With respect to the Constitution, I think let's engage on the amendment bill that is there, because I think there are different interpretations about what the effect of the amendment is. You know, I mean, if there are significant changes, then we need to have a look at them. But I think if they do necessitate a constitutional amendment, I'm not sure, you know, we can avoid it. I think this is really more a political issue. And I think this committee, when it engages politically, I think it should be able to resolve it. But we note the input that has been made, including the input that has been made today around this particular issue. With respect to backlogs, our colleague agree with you and share the sentiment that somebody should be held accountable. I think it's easy for me to say because I know it won't be the department, it's the judiciary. We should engage. People should be held accountable for a very simple reason. There's no reason why they should issue the bench law. You know, there are people who are in charge of the court. And in the High Court, it's the judge's president and the deputy judge's president. So if there's a huge bench law around the field, maybe they should be the ones who come in to explain why there's a huge bench law in the jurisdiction. In the legislative court, it's the regional court president and chief magistrate. In terms of the regulations and the law, it's clear that they are the ones that are accountable. So they can come forward and explain why there are huge bench law. I must say that in many cases there are very good reasons why there are backlogs. And I think, you know, part of the process is the volume. And, you know, in the regional courts, for example, part of the challenge is the fact that, as I said earlier, we arrest people relatively quickly enough. But the investigation process takes too long. You know, and as a result, people must keep making court appearances. So the courts do not have a choice but to postpone those matters consistently until such time that there's a complete investigation. And there's nothing the prosecution service can do either, because there's nothing to prosecute because there's still a further investigation. So that's why then as a cluster, we spend a lot of time engaging with the police to see how they can get the investigation concluded as quickly as possible so that we know whether we're starting with the trial or the matter is getting withdrawn. So those types of matters, those types of backlog, there's really little by way of intervention that the NPA and the department can do in that society. It's very purely and squarely in the hands of the judiciary and in the hands of authorities. I think there are other news, Chair. I mean, just informal engagement to try and understand what there are already those types of engagements with the judiciary. You know, the minister engages with the heads of courts on a regular basis, and they discuss some of these things, but not in sufficient detail. In our view, it's something that we hope we can be able to improve on. But again, I think when the judiciary seeks to appoint new judges, and similarly when the magistrate commission appoints new magistrates, there surely can be an opportunity where these types of issues are discussed, because they have raised in the past to end all of these vacancies and these appointments that they need more judges and they need more magistrates, and the executive has consistently provided a particular resource, but the volumes also just keep coming. And remember that we're also pressured with the infrastructure. You know, in the job of South High Court, for example, we're now actually moving the NPA out of the High Court to create space for judges, to create new chambers. So we're consistently under pressure to provide more space because there's just more and more cases coming through the system. So yes, it is fair to criticize the system where we feel it's inefficient, but I think to be fair, we must look at the overall causes of these types of pressures, and there is just more and more cases coming through the system. But there can be a way, certainly, in which this committee, together with the executive, find a way in which there's a structured engagement with the judiciary. Maybe a colloquium could help on this. What the department is doing is that we're now producing reports on backlog of cases in the various courts. So we can give you a breakdown of the courts for the case backlog to deal with this. So, yes, we're all concerned about the issue of backlog and these things to be dealt with. With respect to vacancies, the Magistrate Commission and the JSC should look into it. Part of the challenge we've noted is that these structures sit on set time in a year. For example, they meet once a quarter on average. But you find that the type of work that they have to deal with and the volumes in which they have to deal with, they are not always able to resolve them per city. So if there's huge vacancies in the Magistrate Commission, it may not be desirable that they see that for the normal schedule. Maybe better that they see more often than not to just go through the backlog. So those are some of the things that engaging with them as the executive, there can be those efforts, and this committee can assist in them. Correct. Special courts and putting CCTV cameras, that's part of the program this year. We've actually made a specific allocation towards the regional court. So that is on work. We're trying to make sure that every regional court has CCTV cameras to deal with those matters. It's part of the implementation as well of the sexual offences legislation. And I've dealt with the civil files scanning. Legal aid, that's going to be one of the biggest problems one of the biggest challenges that this committee deals with. Remember that the legal aid has consistently been arguing for greater jurisdiction in civil matters. And consistently, we've been expressing concerns about the desirability of extending jurisdiction of the legal report to civil matters, because in terms of the Constitution, that's not what they originally intended to do. They're supposed to deal with criminal defense. So if they're going to be extending that jurisdiction, it has to be informed by very clear political objectives. What is happening in the country is that, and the legal aid board may not be the avenue through which to resolve some of those challenges, is that with increased litigation and increased demand for legal services, there is an increase in legal fees and costs, and therefore people can't afford lawyers. I mean, I'm sure if I were a lawyer, I wouldn't be able to afford me. It's a reality that is out there. And therefore, the legalist board, because it uses a mean test, we have a lot of people that fall in between. There's a huge chunk of people that fall in between. And the question is whether those people should be acquitted through the legalist. And consistently it's been said that it's not the desirable route. The desirable route is to put pressure within the legal system for, ensuring that one, there's more legal practitioners out there, which the system is able to do because there's a lot of graduates out there. The problem is that we don't have control over fees. The question is, should fees be kept in the same way that fees are kept for medical practitioners? But again, when those debates come up, there's a question of whether one is now interfering with an independent legal profession and those types of things. But the truth of the matter is not so much in the shortage of lawyers in South Africa. It's the fees that are skyrocketing for legal fees. So if on average, a first year professional assistant starts charging 800 per hour, then you know you have a problem because not many people can afford that much. So what then happens is that there's pressure then on the system to provide free legal services. In divorces, for example, anybody can, even you, if you were under those circumstances, if you chose, you could simply go to court and get the assistance of the court officials in the divorce court to get what the state expense. The only challenge is that if it's contested, the other partner may then come with a legal representative if he or she can afford, and you would have to rely on the resources provided by the state. So in a way, the state already provides legal aid in the form of free legal services in those types of matters. So the original intent is to cover people that completely cannot afford, but we find by and large that quite a number of civil servants actually use the court system for this type of thing. So it is something to do. But whether you provide some of this assistance through the legal aid board, I think it's something that requires greater attention. The committee report, I think we did respond to this. I'll just check in the department. I think we did respond and we submitted the report in writing. I'll just check. If we haven't, I'll make sure we do very shortly. But my recollection is that we did respond. I remember the issues here. So, for example, on the Sagera report, there is a report that was done by our internal forensic unit, and there's a report on that, and we've just given it to the AG's office, which was in the report now. So we can give you those details so we can say exactly what happened. I think all that will arise out of it. The point I raised here is that you won't find that people were illegally awarded something, but you find that there's a question raised about the process that the committee followed at some stage in the process. So I'm still not concerned about it, but I think for ease of the members, I think we will give them the report. And I don't think it's something we should be, we're not too concerned about it, other than just in the normal course of ensuring stronger system. So I'll just check with the policy. The various proposals, yes, Chair, they will come back to the committee. Mr. Swart correctly mentioned that the DNA bill. So when you see the proposed legislative program, which will contain some of the proposals that come out of the review, some have already been implemented. This committee last year, I think, passed the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which deals with bail to improve the procedure for bail processes. What it did was it introduced a new stage in a bail process around the required to say if the prosecutor, before the prosecutor is apparent that the testimony is appearing for a bail application, cannot afford bail, there must be some inquiry to try and determine the person's ability to pay. So that also came out of the review, but because we were able to put it through the General Laws Amendment Act, we were able to put it through this committee party by school. So some of those things have already been implemented, so we can bring a progress report through the minister or the deputy minister on some of the progress. So you'll find a couple of exciting things that have already been implemented around this, or that are in the process of being implemented. The bill coming through, the human trafficking bill, will be one of those that will be coming through. So what's really pushing that? The other one that should be coming through, I think, is the Muslim marriage bill. It will also be coming through. So I think we should wait for the parliamentary program in that respect. On strategy, I think the questions that are raised are useful because they never plan better. I mean, we constantly engage in the department about whether really our MTSF reflects truly what we do and what we should be doing. let me put it this way. You know, the crux of the matter is that the Justice Department is basically a giant law firm. I mean, that's basically what it is. We're just a giant law firm. Because we really just provide legal services, be they family services, be they criminal services, be they, you know, commercial services, be they, you know, we're just a giant law firm. And what we've noted is that, unfortunately, while law firms where the lawyers are not dominant in the employment, in the sense that, again, it's a historical issue. You know, the administration of justice in this country has consistently been approached as an administrative issue. So if you went to any court today, you're likely to find that most of the people that provide service are not necessarily lawyers. They are clerks. That's why you find it even in the court. The people that deal with the matter that you bring are clerks. They're likely to be paralegal. But likely somebody is standard 8 or standard 10. And those people know process. So in other words, they know how a document moves from point A to point B. But they don't necessarily know the legal content. You see? And so if you are going to pursue a transformative agenda, you're going to change that policy. And that's going to take years. You're not going to do it in a short space of time, because what it means, your whole reorientation of the administration of justice has to change to be purely legal, which means you now have to start recruiting really your core legal graduates, your lawyers, to perform some of these services, as opposed to a traditional approach. The question, what do you do with the people that are in the meantime? You know, you can't do anything else but keep training and maintaining them and hoping that many start and graduate as lawyers. But by and large, if you're not a lawyer, because you have an option, you don't go to court, you go to a law firm. But the problem is that those that can't afford to go to a law firm have what's available, which is what's there in the court. And it may not be the same in terms of skills. That's why you find that when it deals with divorce matters and maintenance matters, many of the people that complain about the services they get there, either they appear in court and the other side, usually a male partner, comes with an advocate or an attorney. And the skills are all of a sudden different. You know, and then they're able to put a better argument and therefore get a better outcome out of that case than that particular person, who likely would be represented by court officials with some, in majority of cases, won't be an impact. So I think those are things that we're talking about. So when we try and strategize, we try and look and say, what is our core business? Our core business is provision of legal services. You know, people come there to say, we've got a deceased member of the family, can we please have a letter of executorship? Which is another issue we must have. In terms of the relevant legislation, I think the succession legislation, I can't remember what it's actually called. The people that deal with the administration of the estate, it's not the department, it's the executor or the executrix, who is a person appointed by the family. So the family comes to say, we appointed Uncle X to do this, so please issue this person. We don't have a choice in the department, a private member. So we then issue accordingly and apply and issue to the right person, and that person then becomes the person that's responsible. Part of the delay is because within the family there are disputes, and we can't intervene in that type of dispute. We wait until that executor finishes. The only time we can intervene is when there's a definite fraud. So sometimes, for example, you find that that particular uncle, the family member, in finalizing the estate and distributing the assets, forgets that the partner maybe had 3 or 4 other kids elsewhere that were previously not known about, who now must be included as beneficiaries in the estate, and that person doesn't want to include. So we get those types of contents, and then we try and intervene to make sure everybody is brought on board. But by and large, if that part of the state over which the executive has no control, once you issue a letter of executorship to X, chosen by that family member, we're pretty much out of the picture until such time that that person concludes a particular exercise. And in terms of the act, there is a time frame, I think it's 4 months or 5 months, within which that person must do this. So we can only intervene when the period ends and you've not received a liquidation and distribution account. Then we say, you have delay, then they normally ask for an extension of the month or two, we give an extension, then they must come back with what is left, and then we just check that everything has been collected and the master signs off for distribution. That's pretty it. That's all we do with the master's office. So a large chunk of that work is a private matter between private parties. So there's no scope for intervention. So if government wants to intervene more in the private lives of people, you recommend the legislation and then seek to intervene. But I'm sure people are going to want a justification why government is to that extent in their private life. So it's really more a question of continued education with the public to say, this is the best way to go about it. Only to offer advice, to say, this is your recourse. and already it has been under extreme circumstances. So I think, again, the work of the master has always been not so clearly understood in that particular context. We've just understood it, we spent a lot of time going through each process to see who is responsible for what initiative, and we, lo and behold, discovered that it's actually not the primary function of government to deal with some of those things. So when we do plan, then we say, what do we try to do? So we've got a few strategic goals, three, and they're very broad, as you can see. But then within each, there will have to be a lot of strategic objectives, because there's quite a lot of activities that go in there. With respect to the criminal side, I think it's the simplest, because all we do is prosecution. So that is the simplest. But on the civil side, and bearing in mind that we're providing a free legal space as government, then you must know that people are free to come to government for any type of thing. And we're enjoined to provide. We can't send people away. You know, so people, when they come for family-related matters, to say that they're divorced in the divorce court, I need a family advocate, we must just provide. So as we've been providing this service and rolling them out, the challenge we've been having is that there's an increase in the demand. As soon as people discover that I can get the service for free from government, there's a huge demand for it. Then we don't have corresponding the people to provide the service. So family advocates, for example, is one of these types of matters, because maintenance goes together with, sometimes divorces and family related things. In terms of the Child Care Act, for example, again, the requirements provided, we cannot provide the in areas where people never ever knew that there are actually such services that can be provided. So it gets worse all the time. And if you're talking about 20, 25 million people that are really disadvantaged and are dependent on the state, there is a huge increase. And I think it's something that government can think about. That's why the legal aid has come to raise this point to say, but maybe it should be then allowed to have an increase in jurisdiction to cover things. And then those people will then get the presentation. What it basically means is that we'll then shift resources from where we currently have them in the courts, provide the results to the legal aid and legal aid body, say, give all the civil service and also a criminal service. So it's something really to think about. Something really to think about. The question should extend if somebody wants to sue another for some, you know, defamation, just because they can't afford the lawyer to sue. Should the state provide them, you know, lawyers to which to do this? You know, it's an ongoing debate that really, really can only be resolved at a political level. But in the meantime, the department has to try and provide whatever services can give it. So our then strategic goals, the study of objectives, become very many, because it's that service delivery strategic approach of government to say it's operation. All these operations, and for us, operation means get accommodation, employing more people, get accommodation, employing more people, and then it's the quality of those people, and then it's training. So it's repetition, heavy repetition. It just varies in degree from province to province. You know, we're going to provide family advocate services in the Northern Cape, find accommodation, employ 5 to 10 people. There's pressure. If there's cases, you grow that particular service in that year. You move to Limpopo, you move to Northern Cape, and it's the same thing, but it's exactly the same service. But the main thrust is that people can't afford the service themselves. You know, that's the main problem, because legal services are expensive. We have partnerships with law clinics where we place interns to help boost the law clinics, to save a lot of law clinics from shutting down, because they now use the officials for which we pay. Again, it's a free service to the public. The taxpayer pays through a program of government. If people had an option, then the means, they're still going to their own lawyers without even starting coming to government. So we'll only see a bridge as more people get free. So for as long as there's a poverty problem in South Africa, government will be there with it. So when we then plan as far as strategies are concerned, we're just trying to accommodate operationally all those people. And then obviously, the more it goes to the court, the more pressure it goes. And infrastructure and system as well, which is why then we've been pushing one of the bills that is before Parliament, or I think it's becoming shortly, the one traditional courts bill. Because we're now trying to say, how do we relieve the pressure of the normal court system? And we may need other alternative means like mediation and all of these things. What the rules board is looking at to deal with the issue of speedy trial is try and find a way in which, through court rules, we can have impose the compulsory court mediation before you get a trial date, so that you can fix that matter that are completely trial ready from those that are not. So those are the issues. As far as the AG, well, so on, with respect to the budget, because the demand of our services continues to grow and we don't necessarily have the corresponding growth in the budget, notwithstanding the modest growth that we get, is that we then try to squeeze ourselves and our own budget, squeeze an extra $1 million or $2 million to provide the services. So we look at that all the time. So it becomes a strategic goal in that sense, to say if we can find a saving, we can perform another service that is in demand or supplementary service that is in demand. The AG report, yes, I think, I mean, there were those issues of concern that were raised last year. I think we provided the AG currently with an update of how those issues have been addressed, and the draft report that is there has been very positive, and you will see the annual report and audit report when it comes, Chair. But I think we can provide the report to the AG in response to those particular issues that are raised. So that will address the point that Mr. Trump raised and Mr. Lenders raised around the AG report. So the budget will have to manage. We don't have a separate budget per se. As I said, I mean, to build each of those high costs is not going to cost 120 million. That's for a basic regional cost. The budget for that is not available, but it will cost close to 250 million or so to build each of those costs. But because we are still struggling with the process of obtaining the appropriate land, we've managed now with Mpogo to get the land through the council there in Bologwane, and the process of construction has begun. There was a toast-tending ceremony last year, where we are engaging public works again, because it's through them that we get this, in respect to Mpumalanga. Mpumalanga, we're struggling to get land. It's a public work together. We'll try that here, then we have some. So I think it's something that has been elevated to the DG there, and was previously elevated even at the premier level. But the Minister of Public Works is pleased with the matter and has been trying to assist facilitate the particular process. We hope they'll be able to make a breakthrough. But we're expecting that the second court in Bologna should start hearing criminal matters. Because we provided that infrastructure through the JP, and therefore we should be able to alleviate that problem. But in terms of having its own cost, at least 15 to 18 months from now, we expect that cost to be completed. Mpumalanga, we still have to find it.
Well, thank you very much. I think we should be looking at the components. And we resume at 2 o'clock. Yeah.
If you look at the structure on the program, it appears that the DG is helping the staff strategy program 1, 2, 3, and 4. Is it not correct to say after lunch we're dealing with the MTI?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry to announce this very sad news that we don't provide
lunch.
I hope I'm correct.
I just wanted to call out subtly and tell you, since I've been trying to I see, so that's how you go. Thank you, Maral. I'll do it again.